Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with last night's worst mass shooting in US history, carried out by a 64-year-old man armed with 10 rifles and 9 handguns, who fired on a crowd leaving a country music concert from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Hotel in Las Vegas, killing 58 and wounding 515. Joining us is an expert on the impact that high-powered firearms have on the human body and a researcher who studies death and injury statistics in America, when 92 Americans die from guns every day, with American kids 14 times more likely to die from guns than children in other developed countries. Dr. David Hemenway, the director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and the Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center, and author of While You Were Sleeping, Success Stories in Injury and Violence Prevention, will examine the folklore and romanticism surrounding guns. We will discuss the myth pervading in our gun culture that firearms offer security, when it is increasingly clear from repeated mass shootings that the greatest threat to our lives and liberty is the NRA, who placed the right of gun owners to acquire unlimited, unregulated firepower over the right of American citizens to be safe, with the right to bear arms envisioned within, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, as the Second Amendment promises. Then we will get an update on the overwhelmingly negative reaction around the world to the Spanish government's brutal suppression of the Catalan referendum, with riot police beating up citizens trying to vote in a democratic country. Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, a professor of Spanish criticism and interpretive theory at the European Union Center at the University of Illinois, and author of A Singular Nation, Fantasies of Democratic Normalcy in Spain, and Engaging the Emotions in Spanish Culture and History, joins us to discuss how Spain's heavy-handed overreaction has increased support for Catalan independence. Then finally, we will speak with Jason Fagoni, the author of The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies, a new book about a poet and Shakespeare scholar who, along with her husband, laid the foundation of American counterintelligence. Today, as the FBI and the NSA lead a highly visible and potentially regime-changing counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign's connections to Russia, we will discuss how Elizabeth Smith and William Friedman later became estranged from the agency they helped establish after their home was raided by the NSA. And joining us now is Dr. David Hemenway, who is an economist and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and the Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center, a former Pew Fellow on Injury Control. He held a Robert Wood Johnson Investigator Award in Health Policy Research and is the past president of the National Association of Injury Control Research Centers and won the Excellence in Science Award from the Injury Section of the American Public Health Association. In 2012, he is recognized by the Centers for Disease Control as one of the 20 most influential injury and violence professionals over the past 20 years, and his most recent book is While You Were Sleeping, Success Stories in Injury and Violence Prevention, which is a collection of success stories in injury prevention. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Hemenway.
Thank you.
And it's hard to, as I'm sure you woke up, as I did, to this horrible news that at least 58 people were killed, over 500 wounded in Las Vegas. The figures will probably go up in terms of deaths. But do you think anybody really, except for perhaps trauma surgeons in emergency rooms, have any concept of what bullets do to bodies?
No, I don't, and which I guess is too bad, because it's just so horrific. Unless you've sort of seen these people, you don't really understand how terrible a shooting can be.
And in terms of the research that you've done, you're quoted in New York Times saying that every day some 92 Americans die from guns, and American kids are 14 times as likely to die from guns as children in other developed countries. What is the overall driver of that, do you think?
It really looks like it's the guns. When we compare the United States to all the other high-income countries, there's basically two dozen other high-income countries, Germany and France and Japan and Italy and New Zealand and Canada and so forth, that we are an average country in terms of non-gun violence and non-gun crime. And it's only in one area of crime and violence that we're really different. It's gun crime and gun violence. We have by far the most guns, probably the most militarized guns, lots and lots of handguns, and we also have the weakest gun laws of any of these two dozen countries.
Well, in this case, the shooter in Las Vegas was found with 19 guns, ten of which were long rifles,
yeah.
Some of which I believe were automatic, fully automatic.
That's very unusual, since we basically made it very hard for the wrong people to get machine guns in the 1930s, when that was, the gun of choice of the mafia, and basically to get these guns out of people's hands, we made them difficult to get, along with made silencers difficult to get. So machine guns are almost never used in the United States in crime.
But it's not difficult to convert an AR-15 semi-automatic to fully automatic, and I believe on the internet you can find ways to do it, and gun shows, etc. It's not totally surprising that this fellow had...
That this could have happened, right?
Yeah. So the statistics, though, again, since 1970, more Americans have died from guns, including suicide, murders, and accidents, than the sum total of all Americans who died in all of the wars in American history going back to the American Revolution.
Yeah.
These are such staggering and sobering figures, you'd wonder why we don't have a sensible debate. The president, of course, offered his condolences to the victims today, but no mention of guns. Why is it that the 900-pound gorilla in these incidents always gets ignored? I mean, or at least nothing gets done about it. It's not that it gets ignored. I mean, people are alarmed. I'm personally alarmed, as I've been and as people were, particularly after the Sandy Hook massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. But nevertheless, as we all know, and I recall President Obama breaking down in tears because he couldn't get anything done after a bunch of little kids got murdered.
Yes. So I'm not a political scientist, so I'm not the expert on this, but it seems as if in the United States, single-issue lobbies have a great deal of power, and the gun lobby has too much power in terms of fighting against regulations and the enforcement of regulations, which could make a difference. In public health, our focus is on harm reduction, where we think that there'll probably be many guns in the United States, so we want to try to figure out how to live with our guns rather than currently too many of us are dying from the guns.
Well, the Second Amendment, which is, of course, is the Bible, if you will, of the NRA, and it's always brought up all the time, it actually is not very complicated. This is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The way I read it, a well-regulated, and obviously we don't have militias anymore, we have National Guard, but still the well-regulated part does seem to stand out, and being necessary to the security of a free state. Have we reached a point where our personal security, our freedom to walk the streets of this country without being shot, is more important than the freedom of people like this mass shooter in Las Vegas to be able to buy 19 guns?
Right. Well, one would hope so, but I don't know if we've reached that tipping point yet. You have to realize that first that the Second Amendment was always about what you were saying, a militia, until the 2008 5-4 verdict, which made it somehow read that a gun that people had the right to have a handgun in the home. But the courts have since, in the last 10 years, mostly held that a lot of reasonable gun laws are constitutional.
So in terms of the work that you do, going back to my original question, how do we get the public to understand, or particularly kids to understand? I think in many ways it's a cultural issue in this country, the idea that from television and movies, it's always the gun that settles the problem. And I think young men and boys are infected by this idea. And when we learn about these mass school shootings, it's always some young kid with a grudge who thinks that by bringing a gun to school, he's going to get some attention and settle scores and be a man, etc. How much do you see this, though? I know you deal with the medical issues of gun trauma, but in terms of the psychology of why guns are so attractive in this country to so many people.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing to be attractive because there's a lot of evidence that boys are attracted to guns. But it's, you know, another thing to give boys easy access to military weapons, to give them easy access to these instruments of killing. You can, you know, when you're young, you can be attracted to lots of things. But, you know, in the rest of the developed world, young children, you know, young kids aren't given such easy access to handguns and so forth.
So we get back to the NRA, right? But the NRA is actually only, in effect, the lobbying arm of the gun and ammunition manufacturers. That's what they are in essence, isn't it?
If you look at their policies, they seem to, almost all their policies help increase gun sales. And they seem to be against any policy which reduces gun sales. That's certainly true. But the industry is not that huge. It's not as big as, say, the tobacco industry or the alcohol industry or the automobile industry in the United States. But I think the gun lobby has power in part because it's able to mobilize a small, in terms of percentage of the population, a small constituency who is very rabid, and it, you know, goes to hearings and makes themselves known. And so most people could be for, you know, universal background checks. The evidence is that 80 to 90% of the U.S. population is for that, but they typically don't write their congressman. They don't vote on whether their congressman supports or doesn't support universal background checks. And the gun lobby does. So if I go to a hearing about guns, there'll be maybe a trauma surgeon and myself a researcher and maybe one or two gun victims, and then there'll be a lot of NRA members who are making the most noise and who are there most prominently.
And ironically, of course, today we learn on the stock exchange the shares for guns and gun manufacturers have gone up, and the shares of MGM, which is owns the Mandalay Hotel, have gone down.
Uh-huh.
So what seems to happen when you have mass shootings is that people buy more guns on the premise that actually something's going to be done about gun control, which of course usually...
Or else they buy it because of fear, and somehow they have this fear that the only way they can protect themselves is if they get guns. And someday that might be true, and it's not true for most people today, but someday... You know, if we further allow guns every place in the United States and have further weakened our gun laws, that if more and more people are carrying guns all the time, then it may make sense for everybody to be carrying guns, and we'll have a very dangerous, even more dangerous society than we have today.
Well, we have more guns than people in the United States, but the hotel, for example...
But only about 20% of the U.S. population, or 21 or 2% of the U.S. adult population are gun owners, and only about a third of households have guns.
Right.
Half the guns in the United States are owned by about 3% of the U.S. population. So, yes, we have lots and lots of guns, and there's a gun culture, and lots of people have guns for hunting, and more people have guns for self-defense, which probably the evidence indicates that's a mistake, that guns make your home less safe. The big problem for people without guns is that guns make other people less safe, too, as you know, all the people at that concert can testify to.
Well, ironically, of course, the country music concert that was across the street where people were shot down, and it, as I say, at this point, 58 dead, by the time we get off the air, there may be more. 515 injured. Many were shot, but many also were trampled. But it's ironic to think that the NRA on its website has NRA Country, which is an extension of their NRA's efforts to strengthen the gun lobby through partnerships with the country music industry.
Uh-huh.
And the banner on the site encourages visitors to celebrate the lifestyle. And the artists, of course, I could read off a whole list of country artists, many of whom are not that famous, but some of them are known.
Right.
And an NRA official says on the site that the goal of the NRA Country was to present the softer side of the gun lobby. Do you think that there's any chance of that sort of cleavage being made between guns and country music? I mean, it's pretty ironic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Sorry, but mostly it's just so sad.
Yeah.
What's really sad from a public health standpoint is that we could do so much better. I mean, public health really is all about trying to figure out ways to reduce the problems. Public health has been incredibly successful in lots of areas. They haven't eliminated lots of problems, but we've reduced many, many, many problems. And typically, the way that's done is not to change people, which tends to be too often the focus of laws, but to change the environment and to change the product and make it really easy to be healthy rather than difficult to stay healthy.
But in the work that you do, in terms of the testimony you've given to state and federal legislators, you say you're outgunned by the NRA, and of course they give a lot of money. Is there a way to find a counter lobby? I know the former mayor of New York, who's a billionaire, has stepped up. But if it's money that gives the NRA power, do you see any group in this country having a financial interest in wanting to stop this massacre?
Well, I mean, I'm big on success stories and, learning from them. And one of the big success stories in terms of gun laws has been in California. So California used to have sort of average gun laws, and now they have the strongest gun laws in the country. And the reason is because of one foundation, the Wellness Foundation, who, when it was formed, decided that one of its major initiatives would be to try to reduce gun violence in California. And so it gave money for data collection, it gave money for research, it gave money for advocates, and it really helped change the culture. So that you can have really good data which shows, what the world's really like. And they've done an incredible job, I think, and the proof is in the pudding, and gun violent deaths in California have fallen dramatically, much more than in the surrounding states. So it's certainly possible to do things. And individuals can do things. I mean, not so much individually, but to form groups and try to figure out how the group can make their voice heard. There's a lot of religious groups that have been trying to do things with some success.
Well, of course, in Australia, there was a mass shooting in 1996, and the country united behind a national law to round up guns, and it was done by a conservative government, by the
way. Yes, that was key. I think that was key, that it was a conservative government. I mean, we have to, in the United States, I keep waiting for some, brave conservatives to step up and say enough's enough, and it just hasn't happened here, whereas it did happen in Australia. And that law, I mean, basically, there were, I think, 13 mass shootings the 20 years before that law, and there have been zero mass shootings since the law was in effect. Not only did they buy back lots of the assault weapons and so forth, but they also strengthened their gun laws. And there's been a tremendous reduction in gun homicide and gun suicide there.
They've cut it in half. But just in closing then, what do you think it will take? We started out in the, in terms of of the average citizen not having any concept of what it's like. Maybe people should spend some time in these trauma centers, in emergency rooms in inner cities. My daughter's in emergency medicine, and she said that a lot of the military come in and get their training.
Yes. Sad.
Yeah.
Physicians from other countries, these other high-income countries, haven't really treated gunshot wounds, so they come to the United States to learn how to treat them.
But also, military medics get their training because the streets of America are just as bad as the streets of Afghanistan or Iraq.
Right, and they can be. And, one of the big things, too, is that gun violence includes suicide. And so people just don't understand that having a gun in the house increases the risk that someone will die by threefold. Now, that doesn't mean that, oh, my goodness, someone's immediately going to die or something, because these are still fairly rare events, even though, they kill 100 people a day, guns. That's still small relative to 330 million people in the United States. But still, you should, and anything you can do to protect yourself and your children, one of the things typically to do is not to have guns in the home, and especially with kids around. And if you have them, to make sure they're locked up and kids don't have easy access to them.
Well, Dr. David Hemenway, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Hemenway. He's an economist and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and the Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center. He's a former Pew Fellow in Injury Control and held the Robert Wood Johnson Investigator Award in Health Policy Research, and is the past president of the National Association of Injury Control Research Centers, and won the Excellence in Science Award from the Injury Section of the American Public Health Association. And in 2012, he's recognized by the Centers for Disease Control as one of the 20 most influential injury and violence professionals over the past 20 years, and his most recent book is While You Were Sleeping, Success Stories in Injury and Violence Prevention. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update on the overwhelmingly negative reaction around the world to the Spanish government's brutal suppression of the Catalan referendum.
Did it all get real? I guess it's real enough. They got refrigerators full of blood. Another century spent pointing guns at anything that sometimes I worry that I've lost the plot. My twitching muscles tease my flipping thoughts. I never really dreamed of heaven much until we put him in the ground.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, a professor of Spanish criticism and interpretive theory and gender with the European Union Center at the University of Illinois. She's the author of A Singular Nation, Fantasies of Democratic Normalcy in Spain, and her latest book is Engaging the Emotions in Spanish Culture and History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado.
Thank you, Ian.
And it would seem to me that the government of Spain in Madrid has really shot themselves in the foot. If they wanted to contain the notion of Catalonian independence, they've basically put Catalonia on the map. I think the whole world has seen pictures of people wanting to vote to express their democratic right being beaten up by riot police. This happens in third world dictatorships. It doesn't happen in advanced democracies. It's an extraordinarily bad optics, to say the least, isn't it?
It is. And so I am both baffled but not baffled by it. I thought I was, of course, I had been talking to friends and colleagues in the weeks preceding this, and, you know, I thought this might be the case. So the current government in Spain, the Conservative Party, the Partido Popular, has a very authoritarian view of power. They really, a colleague of mine who was just interviewed for NPR, Sebastian Faber, said that it's in its DNA, and you know, many of its members are direct descendants or linked or have family links or to the Francoist regime. And many of them say so explicitly. So, and others don't say it explicitly, but it's not, you know, it's not so hidden at all. So they do have this very authoritarian conception of what power is, and I don't know if they truly understand how, you know, what democratic means are. So they keep, one of the questions that have led to this moment is their repeated insistence on legality, legality, legality. And I actually analyze that in my book, their appeals to normalcy and legality. And they think that that solves all problems. And, of course, that's not what politics is, right? That's not, and certainly that's not what democracy is. So you keep sitting at the table and you stay and you stay until you find a solution. You don't just appeal to laws and rule number one and rule number two, because all advances that we have in civil rights and in our democratic countries came through, you know, sometimes through revolutions and sometimes through persistence. And so I to this day, yesterday or today actually, I saw in the news, they were side by side, the foreign newspapers, the foreign meaning non-Spanish newspapers and the Spanish newspapers. And it really is like two different realities. So most of the Spanish newspapers, the conservative newspapers, the national newspapers are, you know, allude to proportionality, proportional use of force. And the Prime Minister Rajoy said that we have been an example to the world. And of course, all other countries said, well, this has been excessive. This is unbelievable. This is, we cannot. So, you know, we have been an example of anything is an example of what not to do in a democratic regime. But I do not think the government understands the severity of what happened yesterday and, as you say, the optics of the situation. I don't think they do, because they actually have different optics. They have authoritarian optics.
Well, this sounds like America under Donald Trump, where he has his people that watch Fox News, read Breitbart, and watch Sinclair, and listen to Rush Limbaugh, and they're in an alternative universe, believing Trump's lies, and they believe what Trump says, that the rest of the media is fake news. So how does that operate in Spain? In other words, when you say that the mainstream Spanish newspapers have a rosy picture of what happened, according to the conservative government, I mean, there must be opposition. El País, I would have thought, would cover it more accurately, wouldn't it?
You know, El País has been disastrous, and I say that it almost pains me to say that, because I read, as a teenager, I read El País, and it was what everybody read, and it was, you know, the beginning of a democracy, and we were all hopeful, and to see what has become of that newspaper is in fact very sad. But they have had a very hard line on the Catalan issue, extremely hard line. Really, there's no difference between what El País is saying and what the government is saying. So, which is really, of course, this wouldn't have been the case 20 years ago. And there's a couple of, obviously, contributors that soften, you know, that have a softer stance or position. But really, the editorials of El País have been taken aback. And I study this issue, you know, and I read it on a number of other newspapers. But I have been taken aback by the editorials in El País. So, of course, there's other, especially online newspapers like El Diario or InfoLibre, or I mean, there is information out there, and of course people read it. And this is another, I think something that the current government didn't take into account, that they couldn't control the narrative as they could 30 years ago when democracy was starting, and you know, you could have one official narrative and people went, oh, okay, well, this is what it is. Now, I mean, there were so many people with cell phones yesterday, and so the government can say whatever they want to say, but I mean, I've seen hundreds of images and the world has seen them. And so you can say, I'm sure that some police were injured, and of course I regret injuries. I regret the police are injured, but I mean, I have seen the injuries of the civilian population who have no, you know, are not equipped for that. They have no helmets, they have no arms, and it's like, well, I mean, it has been absolutely disastrous. So let me tell you that I knew the government, I saw this more yesterday, you know, what had happened, and I was so concerned. And I knew the Spanish government has lost the battle for the narrative of what happened when I read Fox News. And I read Fox News because I want to read, you know, how precisely their narratives, how they present, you know, their version of reality. And even this is Fox News we're talking about, right? And they were basically saying, how can this happen? This is an excessive use of force. So when you have Fox News saying that police used excessive force, I don't think we need to say anything else.
You know? Right. And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, a professor of Spanish criticism and interpretive theory and gender with the European Union Center at the University of Illinois. She's the author of A Singular Nation, Fantasies of Democratic Normalcy in Spain, and her latest book is Engaging the Emotions in Spanish Culture and History. So presumably a lot of people in Spain saw on television the Catalan-born Gerard Piqué weep openly when questioned about the violence. And that seems to be pretty much what's happened here, is that this thing has backfired so much that the issue has become the heavy hand of the government, as opposed to perhaps political recklessness, shall we say, on the part of Catalan political authorities. But, you know, having an election doesn't mean that the mandate's going to be carried out. It's more of a gesture. So, again, you just get the feeling that this is a thuggish, paranoid overreaction on the part of the Madrid government. So what happened? Are you hearing anything about how this football idol, I would think he has some influence over the average Spaniard?
Oh, no. Well, so I had written on Piqué because I wrote an article about how the winning the World Cup, the Soccer Cup, had united Spaniards more than anything else, right? And as you remember, in that team there were many players from the football club Barcelona, right? Some were from Barcelona and others were not. Iniesta is from La Mancha, but Piqué is a Catalan. But, you know, whenever Piqué is a very controversial figure because he's an excellent player, but he's also a very vocal supporter of the Catalan referendum, and he's a Catalanist. You know, he really is very Catalan. And so because he has made open statements about that in public, he has been booed constantly whenever he plays with a national team, you know, with La Selección. And that has been the subject of innumerable articles about it. And so yesterday he said something, and, you know, I'm not a great soccer fan, and I'd study it for different reasons. But, I mean, I read what he said, and it was really interesting because he said that when he plays for the national team, he plays to the best of his ability, which is true. He's a very good player. And that he didn't know that was like a contest for the most patriotic player. It was like, you know, the question was to play well and honestly and try to win, and that's what he did. But if it bothered people so much that he was part of the national team, then he would quit early, because he had already said that he would not play beyond 2018. And then, you know, as you know, he was almost in tears. And then there were many conservatives that mocked the tears and were making, you know, plays of words with the tears and all that. So, you know, I think he is perceived to be such a defender, or he's so associated with the issue of Catalan independence, or at least greater autonomy, federal government or something, that even when his partner, Shakira, is with him, sometimes she's booed in Madrid too, because she has learned some Catalan and she sang a song in Catalan and she was booed too. So the divide, the cultural divide between Catalonia and you know, not, I wouldn't say the rest of Spain, but a big part of the sort of especially conservative Spain is huge. It's really huge.
Well, again, echoes of Donald Trump using the national anthem phony issue about patriotism as a way to distract from the real issue.
Right.
The players were protesting, which is police violence against African Americans. So I guess just in closing, it does seem this Spanish activist, or this Catalan activist, described this weekend's incidents in Catalonia as the Spanish government is like an abusive husband. He says he loves you, and he says he can't live without you. Then he beats you to stop you from leaving.
Well, but again, that's an authoritarian conception of power, right? And the referendum, was it illegal according to Spanish constitutional law? Yes, it was. Could it have been legal if there had been the political willingness to make it so? Absolutely. You know, the Spanish constitution was changed in the middle of a crisis just to appease the European Union. It was done at night, and so if we could change the constitution for that, why cannot we change it to open that dialogue? But the central tenet of Spanish conservative nationalism is the unity of the nation, which is, again, very similar to what's happening in the United States with the ultra-right wing, right? Like one country and, you know, in that case, it's like one country, Christian country, a white country. Well, in Spain, it's different, but this idea of the unity of the nation, the nation who is Castilian-speaking, it is this one nation. There cannot be more than one, and not even on paper. And if you don't like it, we're going to, you know, make you submit by force. And again, that is an authoritarian understanding of power, and it's not a democratic understanding of power, but there we are.
And of course, again, echoes of the Spanish Civil War, since it was authoritarian power that united Spain in blood, as opposed
and
to...
There were several issues that, you know, led to the war, but one huge issue even then was, you know, Catalonia and the Basque Country's desire for, at the time, you know, autonomy and respect for their local languages. And one Francoist official infamously said, it is better read than broken, which is a play of words in Spanish, mejor roja que rota, you know, because they said, so they, as much as they hated communism, they hated separatism even more. So, yes, so that authoritarian mentality, that idea that we cannot even sit down to discuss the fact that Catalonia might be a historical nation, the fact that that cannot be discussed is, in fact, goes back even further to into the 18th century, but it's certainly related to the Civil War and everything that happened after it.
Well, Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, who's a professor of Spanish criticism and interpretive theory and gender with the European Union Center at the University of Illinois. She's the author of A Singular Nation, Fantasies of Democratic Normalcy in Spain, and her latest book is Engaging the Emotions in Spanish Culture and History. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the author of a new book, The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies.
Sabes bien que soy hombre de campo y que solo tengo un descapotable. Cuando llegue el próximo domingo, voy tráelo para impresionarte. Tengo un tractor amarillo, que es lo que se lleva ahora. Tengo un tractor amarillo, porque llena un...
I'm a spy in the house of love. I know the dream that you're dreaming of. I know the word.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jason Fagoni, who's a journalist who covers science, technology, and culture, named as one of the 10 young writers on the rise by the Columbia Journalism Review. He's a contributor to the Huffington Post and has written for GQ, Esquire, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and Mother Jones. And his latest book just out is The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Fagoni.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And of course, there's a lot of focus now on FBI counterintelligence and the National Security Agency in terms of looking into Trump campaign's possible connections with Russia. And the heroine of this story, of course, was a pioneer in American counterintelligence, starting out in unlikely places like the Coast Guard. It does seem that the U.S. took a while to... I mean, when you look at the size of the National Security Agency today, it used to be jokingly referred to as no such agency. But it's hard to... it's almost, you know, takes up huge amounts of acreage there in Fort Meade. So it's pretty amazing.
Today there's 20,000 people who work in Fort Meade, and what was surprising about this story for me is that the National Security Agency had this very humble and kind of outlandish beginning. The seeds of the NSA were really planted during the First World War in 1916, which is where this story begins, and the very first NSA codebreakers weren't at all like the kinds of, you know, mathematicians and analysts who work today in Fort Meade. Instead, they were this group of kind of ragtag amateur Shakespeare experts. They were people who spent their days trying to find secret messages in the works of Shakespeare, supposedly written in cipher. And that's how the heroine of this book, Elizabeth Smith Friedman, got her start. She wasn't a mathematician at all. She was a poet and a Shakespeare expert during World War I.
And of course now NSA is it's always run by a four-star, so it's very militarized. These were eccentric civilians, to say the
least. No, absolutely. It has. I mean, like a lot of things in American history, if you dig a little deeper, you find amateurs at the very beginning. And the thing about America in 1916 is, you know, I had always had this impression that these intelligence agencies, like the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, that they had kind of always existed, right? They seem so powerful and mighty today. But when you go back, you see that they're really very recent, and that the whole idea of an American intelligence community is extremely recent. You know, 1916, when the book begins, when Elizabeth's story begins, America really has no intelligence community. There's no NSA, there's no CIA. And the FBI is just kind of a small seed of what it would become in the future. And so when America joined World War I in 1917, all of these military generals looked around and they said, we really need to know what the enemy is saying. We really need to be able to solve the secret messages of Germany, and yet we have nobody in America who even knows what a code or a cipher is. The only people who seemed to know what codes and ciphers were these folks out in the middle of nowhere in Illinois, these literature experts who were looking for secret messages in Shakespeare. And so that's how, you know, Elizabeth very quickly went from working on this kind of eccentric Shakespeare project to, in 1917, being recruited into the World War I effort as a military codebreaker.
And Elizabeth Smith, of course, is the heroine of your new book, The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. And her husband, William Friedman, is considered the founder of the National Security Agency. So let's start with this extraordinary beginning. And of course, when you talk about World War One and secret codes, it was, after all, the Zimmerman telegram that in many ways got the Americans into that war. And
yes.
British intelligence, of course, had a role in that.
Absolutely. So the Zimmerman telegram, you're absolutely right, was a secret message sent by Arthur Zimmerman, a German official, to officials in Mexico in the beginning of 1917. America was not in the war. Woodrow Wilson was trying extremely hard to keep America out of the war, but along comes Zimmerman. He sends this telegram to Mexico proposing a secret alliance between Germany and Mexico, and as part of this secret alliance, Germany promises to return the territory of Texas to Mexican control. And what happened was there was a team of British codebreakers, you know, in a secret room in Whitehall, who had managed to intercept this message as it traveled from Germany to Mexico, and they broke the code, and they revealed the secret message of Zimmerman, which is what codebreakers do. They essentially solve puzzles. They solve a secret message without knowing the key. And so the British codebreakers revealed this message, this kind of conspiracy plot by Germany against America. And when this became public, when Woodrow Wilson saw it and it became public in the newspapers, it was a huge scandal. It was front page news all over America, and it helped to push us into World War One, because people were shocked and angry that Germany was trying to push this conspiracy against us. And so America went to war very suddenly without really having the preparation in being able to solve these secret messages. Britain had a team, but America did not. And so this is how the heroine of the book, Elizabeth Smith, gets started. She is told to put a halt to her Shakespeare investigations, and all of a sudden, messages from Washington, D.C. start being sent to her. She's working in the middle of the Illinois prairie, employed by this kind of eccentric tycoon named George Fabian. And so these messages are traveling from Washington, D.C. out to the prairie, and Elizabeth Smith is looking at them, and, you know, she's not a mathematician. She's a poetry analyst, but she has to figure out under wartime pressure how to solve all these messages. And that's what happens next is kind of one of the great stories in American intelligence, and I think in 20th century American history, because what happens is working alongside William Friedman, who at that time is a young plant biologist, a geneticist, Elizabeth and William proceed to invent an entire new science of cryptology, of codes and ciphers, working in, you know, across a desk from each other with nothing but pencil, paper in their minds, because this is all in the era before computers. They essentially invent the modern science of codes and ciphers that today is at the root of our contemporary intelligence agencies. It's kind of one of these mysterious and wondrous stories. How did they do it? And it's one of the things that I kind of wanted to figure out.
And of course, in the interregnum between World War I and World War II, Elizabeth was hired to essentially, you know, round up the rum runners during Prohibition, right? They had secret codes, and she was. Which part of the government hired her then to crack down on or to expose the network of bootleggers?
Absolutely. So, so after Elizabeth left this place in the prairie after World War One, she and William moved to Washington D.C. and Elizabeth stayed home. She had her first child. And she thought she was just going to be a stay-at-home mom. She was taking care of this kid, and she was writing children's books, and that's kind of what she thought her life would be. But what happened was the Prohibition Law, as we all know, created an enormous organized crime network all of a sudden from nothing. And these criminal gangs became very good, very fast, at using secret codes and ciphers to conceal their communications, because again, these weren't mathematics geniuses, but they had enough money to hire crypto experts. And they would direct these criminal networks of rum ships by using secret codes transmitted by radio. So they would have shortwave radio equipment on their rum ships, and they would have a secret pirate radio station on shore. And they would communicate between shore and ship with coded radio messages that the Coast Guard was not able to read. And so the Coast Guard was essentially completely blind to these very fast and very efficient and very clever networks of criminal rum ships. And so what happened was Elizabeth Friedman was at home taking care of her kid, writing children's books, and one day there was a knock on her door. And a man in a Coast Guard uniform was there and a hat, and he said... he was very polite. He said his name was Charles Root. He was there from the Coast Guard, and he needed her help. He needed her to come break codes for America. And this was also always happening to Elizabeth Friedman, by the way. She said all her life that her career was a pure accident, and that she never intentionally took a job anywhere. What happened was that men from the government were always showing up on my doorstep, is how she put it. They're always showing up on my doorstep asking me to do something for America. And she said that the only way to get rid of them was to say yes and to agree to solve these puzzles. So that's what she did. She said yes, and she went to work for the Treasury Department and started to throw light on these dark criminal networks. She became a master at using radio to light up the hidden networks of criminal gangs. She would intercept their radio messages, solve the codes, reveal the plain text messages that the rum captains and the rum leaders were saying to each other. And she would be able to pinpoint all of their boats and ultimately feed that information to U.S. law enforcement to make arrests. And you had mentioned earlier, Ian, the origin of counterintelligence, this thing that we read about every day today with the Trump-Russia investigation. You know, the Trump-Russia investigation is a counterintelligence investigation, or at least it began that way. Counterintelligence, the art of and science of trying to disrupt foreign spy networks, trying to disrupt foreign spies. To be able to do that, you need to figure out what the spies are saying to each other. Who's saying what to whom? That's all counterintelligence is. And Elizabeth Friedman was a pioneer of American counterintelligence because she was doing counterintelligence with these rum runners during Prohibition, before counterintelligence really was a thing, before there were these large organized teams. She was doing it there on the ground every day solving, you know, hundreds of RUM messages and using counterintelligence strategies to create these very detailed maps of the criminal underworld.
And Jason Fagoni, again, the author of The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. Moving to World War II, she, of course, became extremely important. But, of course, there was a big battle in World War II between the FBI and what became the OSS.
Sure.
Mercifully, Roosevelt must have known some of J. Edgar Hoover's limitations, because Hoover was largely a fraud. He did a lot of public relations and self-promotion, but wasn't particularly good at anything much. But as a compromise, he was given the espionage portfolio for Latin America during World War II, as the OSS took over the main portfolio, which he wanted.
Right.
And, of course, she did a lot of work, Elizabeth Smith, that Hoover took credit for, right?
Well, absolutely. You're right. A famous conflict between the OSS and the FBI. The OSS was led by a guy named Wild Bill Donovan. He did not get along with J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover did not get along with him. You know, this story is fairly well known, but the story that I found here is, I think, a little less well known and kind of surprising. So what happened was, at the dawn of World War II, there was an exodus from Germany of Nazi spies. Hitler began sending Nazi spies throughout the Western Hemisphere. And so spies spread out from Berlin and Hamburg, and they went to, some went to the United States. They didn't get very far inside the United States, but a number of them successfully set up shop in Mexico. And then the bulk of them, large numbers of them, set up shop in South America, which was a neutral territory. But the fact was, there were a lot of German colonists in South American countries, and so there was kind of a natural sympathy for Nazi spies who began to operate there. And when Nazi spies went to South America, they happened to bring the same kinds of radio sets and radio equipments, and the same kinds of codes that the rum runners and smugglers had been using during Prohibition. And so Elizabeth Friedman, in 1938, began to intercept and analyze messages that at first she thought were rum messages or drug smuggler messages. And pretty quickly she realized that they weren't smuggling messages at all. They were messages that were being sent by Nazi spies. They were just extremely familiar to her because they had the same kinds of codes and same kinds of call signs and that sort of thing. So she knew exactly what had to be done at exactly the moment when something had to be done about these Nazi spies. And the fact was, as you said, you know, J. Edgar Hoover was very good at publicizing his expertise, but he lacked a lot of expertise in certain areas, and one of them was code breaking. He had no ability to break codes. The FBI had was something it called a technical research laboratory, and it was really a crime lab for analyzing bullets and that sort of thing. They had no code breakers. They had no code breaking capacity. They had no radio listening stations to get radio intercepts. They had none of the things that you would need to do to be able to read the thoughts of the enemy in the way that code breakers can do, and that is so very valuable. And so J. Edgar Hoover, although he was not he did not think highly of women, he had no choice. He went to the Coast Guard and he asked Elizabeth Friedman and her team for help. And at that point, 1940, the team of Elizabeth Friedman that had spent Prohibition era tackling rum codes and fighting smugglers all of a sudden became immersed in this work of catching Nazi spies and giving the information to Allied intelligence agencies, including the FBI. And throughout the war, Elizabeth became one of the great catchers of Nazi spies in the world. She and her team, a team that she created and trained, a team of elite code breakers working within the Coast Guard, monitored as many as 50 different Nazi clandestine radio circuits all over the world, particularly in South America. She was able to break the codes on these circuits, figure out the names of the Nazi spies. Piece by piece, draw maps of their spy networks, who was talking to whom. And in that way, she was able to give, you know, very clear picture of this hidden world of Nazi spies to all kinds of allied intelligence agencies that were then able to go in and disrupt the rings. And one of the most impressive things about this work to me is that Elizabeth Friedman and her team were able to solve Enigma machines by hand, which was, you know, Enigma is the famous Nazi cipher machine. It's like a typewriter that replaces one letter with another in a very kind of complex way. It's not supposed to be able to be broken, but Elizabeth, sort of just by using, you know, inspired guessing and her experience and intuition, and a pencil and paper, was able to break three of these Nazi Enigma machines used by spies and ultimately eliminate this very dangerous threat.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, we have to move fast through the big other part of World War II, of course, is breaking the Japanese Code Purple, which her husband, William Friedman, did. And he, at great expense to his own health, he effectively established the National Security Agency, but he became rather leery of it, and in a curious way, similar to what Edward Snowden's criticism of the NSA was, that it was keeping too much secrets and was threatening democracy itself. The Friedman's house was raided in 1957 by the NSA, which was, I imagine, quite humiliating for them. But you managed to get hold of all of their personal papers, which they bequeathed to the George C. Marshall Foundation in Lexington, Virginia, and that began your journey right into this story.
Yes, absolutely. So the reason that this book is possible is because the Friedmans became estranged from the U.S. government toward the end of their career. So like you said, you know, William had amazing achievements of his own during World War II. He created the team that broke the Japanese cipher machine known as Purple. It's kind of the Japanese Enigma machine analogous to that. As a result, the Allies were able to read Japanese messages all through the war and get a leg up on the enemy and probably saved many lives and shortened the war. So both Elizabeth and William were American heroes. They, you know, spent their entire careers working for the government, and then toward the end of their career, you know, the government sort of turned on them. It started to see them as a security threat. They almost knew too much, and it culminated in this event that you mentioned. One day in 1958, the National Security Agency sent agents to the Friedman's house and confiscated dozens of papers from their library. Even old papers going all the way back to World War One. You know, they took it away in a truck, and the Friedmans were, you know, humiliated, because for the government to treat them like they were, you know, some kind of threat when they had spent their whole lives serving their country, it didn't make any sense to them. So instead of giving their papers to the government, they gave it to this private library in Virginia, and that's why I was able to walk in and request, you know, the first box of the 22 boxes that Elizabeth Friedman left behind, and start to read her wonderful letters and get a window into this remarkable and untold story of Elizabeth Friedman that I think people should know more about.
Well, they can get hold of your book, The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. And I thank you for joining us, Jason Fagoni.
All right, thanks, Ian. I enjoyed talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Fagoni, who's a journalist who covers science, technology, and culture. He was named one of the 10 young writers on the rise by the Columbia Journalism Review, and he's a contributor to the Huffington Post and has written for GQ, Esquire, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and Mother Jones. And his latest book, just out, is The Woman Who Smashed Codes, A True Story of Love, Spies, and the Unlikely Heroine Who Outwitted America's Enemies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at ianmasters.com, or you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.